From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now! Breaking with Convention, War, Peace, and the Presidency, as we broadcast from the Democratic National Convention in Boston. As Democrats prepare to coronate John Kerry this week, protesters are being told they can protest, but only inside a pit covered in barbed wire.
It is very unfortunate that Boston, which considers itself as the most liberal city in the United States, rather than letting people protest in an open space, decided to put all protesters in a cage.
Then, as 15,000 journalists converge on Boston, the FBI says protesters are plotting to attack the media.
I'm scared, Amy, aren't you? This is a media convention. Here, people with more journalists than delegates here to schmooze rather than do the news. It's interesting that Jim Lehrer of PBS has become the harshest critic of the network non-coverage.
We'll also speak with author Jim Hightower, and we'll hear from Gloria Steinem. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! Breaking with Convention, War, Peace, and the Presidency. We are broadcasting from Boston. The Democratic National Convention begins today. I'm Amy Goodman. The American Civil Liberties Union and the National Lawyers Guild are filing emergency briefs today in Boston to ask the courts to increase the size of the protest zone outside the Democratic National Convention. As the convention officially opens today at the Fleet Center, activist groups have strongly condemned the city for setting aside a small piece of land underneath train tracks for the protest zone. Last week, a court upheld the free speech zone but agreed with protesters that the space resembles an internment camp. Here in Boston, thousands of Democratic Party delegates, elected officials, and journalists are arriving for the convention's opening. Inside the Fleet Center tonight, taking the stage will be former Presidents Bill Clinton and Jimmy Carter, former Vice President Al Gore, Hillary Clinton, and Wisconsin Congresswoman Tammy Baldwin. Outside the Fleet Center, some 5,000 city, state, and federal law enforcement officials have mobilized as part of a $60 million operation. Armed military police are stationed around the convention site. Fighter planes are in the skies. The federal government has set up a massive network of surveillance cameras that are controlled at command centers in Boston and Washington. For the first time in the city's history, police are searching subway passengers and their belongings. We'll have more on the convention coming up. But this news from Iraq: the foreign minister hinted over the weekend that the unelected U.S.-backed Iraqi government may ban Al Jazeera and other Arabic TV stations from broadcasting in Iraq. The foreign minister said stations like Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya are, quote, channels of incitement and opposed to the interests, security, and stability of the Iraqi people. In response, Al Jazeera issued a statement saying, quote, Al Jazeera would have hoped that the Iraqi government would embark on its new term with initiatives to lift media restrictions, not add new ones that would certainly not be conducive to freedom of the press and expression. The acting head of the U.S. Selective Service is calling on Congress to increase its $26 million annual budget in order to be fully prepared to initiate a military draft if needed. This according to a report in the Boston Globe. The director, Jack Martin, told the Globe, quote, we want to be ready to implement a draft, but we are doing nothing in that regard right now, he said. In news from Iran, a court in Tehran acquitted the only defendant in the death of an Iranian-Canadian photojournalist, Zahra Kazemi. Nobel Peace Laureate Shireen Ebadi, the chief lawyer for the mother of Kazemi, announced the decision on Saturday. She called the ruling unfair and said her legal team will bring the case to the appeals court and to international courts if necessary. Kazemi died from a skull fracture and brain hemorrhage in July 2003 while being held for taking photographs outside a Tehran prison during student-led protests against the Iranian government. The government agent charged with killing Kazemi pleaded innocent July 17th, and the trial was abruptly ended the next day. In Israel, up to 150,000 Israelis formed a human chain stretching over 55 miles from Gaza to Jerusalem to protest Prime Minister General Ariel Sharon's plan to pull out of the Gaza Strip. The right-wing Yesha Council of Settlers organized the protest, which was the largest held against the Gaza pullout. Meanwhile, in the West Bank, undercover Israeli forces assassinated six Palestinian militants while they're eating dinner in a restaurant in Tulkarm. Among those killed was the local head of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade. In France, hundreds of protesters led by the farmer José Bové destroyed a field of genetically modified corn over the weekend. Police made no arrests but photographed participants. In news from Capitol Hill, Republican Congressmember Jim Greenwood of Pennsylvania has announced he's retiring in order to become the top lobbyist for the Biotechnology Industry Organization, one of the most powerful pharmaceutical trade groups. Greenwood was a leading backer of last year's Medicare bill, which was strongly supported by the drug industry. And the American Civil Liberties Union is suing the state of Ohio today to replace antiquated punch card ballot machines. The ACLU argues punch card ballots are more likely to go uncounted than votes cast with other systems. In Ohio, which is a battleground state, most of the African American population lives in the counties that use the punch card system. With 99 days until the election, some voting experts say there would not be time to make a conversion to a different ballot system. The punch card ballots are used in 69 of Ohio's 88 counties, representing nearly 73% of registered voters. Several other states sued by the ACLU have reached settlements to replace the punch card ballots. John Coltrane, Peace on Earth, here on Democracy Now!, breaking with convention, war, peace, and the presidency. We're broadcasting from Cambridge Community Television, a public access TV station in Cambridge. Also, welcome to Boston Network, Neighborhood Network viewers, as well as to 240 radio and television stations around the country. We're also broadcasting on Free Speech TV, channel 9415 of Dish Network, and on Link TV, channel 375 of DirecTV. We welcome you. I'm Amy Goodman. Boston's known as the birthplace of U.S. democracy, but many activist groups and civil liberties organizations say the tradition is being trampled on by the security apparatus that's been amassed here in Boston to guard the Democratic National Convention. On Sunday, there was a large permitted rally sponsored by Answer Coalition. There was a sizable presence of riot police and other security forces. Largely, the march went without major incident, but at the very end of the procession through Boston, police arrested one demonstrator in an incident that his lawyers are saying was a case of racial profiling. Here is how a local activist, Scott Cooper, who witnessed the arrest, described the scene.
What we just saw here was what looked like a provocation by the police against the march. There were two uniformed police officers and a plainclothes officer dressed to look like a marcher, you know, baseball cap. No indication that he was a cop except for the gun bulge. And as the march went by, they pointed to a man who looked to be in his late 20s. I think he was Pakistani. They pointed to him and all of a sudden walked right into the crowd and grabbed him from behind. He turned around as if to say, "What did I do?" And then they dragged him into this alley. I was before the whole crowd turned around, I happened to be watching and standing there, and he was trying to shout his name out so somebody could know his name, and they pulled him down out of earshot. And the whole time I could read his lips, "What did I do? What's this all about?" And then the plainclothes officer seemed to be calling the shots. There were a whole bunch of uniformed cops. They formed a line to keep the people who now started to chant, let him go, and wanted to go down the alley to accompany him. And they dragged him down all the way down this alley and put the straps around him. So who knows? I mean, it could have been somebody they were targeting for immigration or something like that. It could have been a deliberate attempt to keep the march, you know, split up the march.
Scott Cooper, who witnessed the arrest yesterday of one of the demonstrators at the anti-war march. With the exception of a handful of permitted marches and rallies, people who want to demonstrate their views during the DNC are told they're free to do so, but only from the discomfort of a so-called free speech zone. Protest organizers refer to it as an internment camp or a detention center. The area the authorities have designated as the official protest area is enclosed by a maze of overhead netting, razor wire, and chain-link fence. The Fleet Center, where the convention's taking place, is barely visible through the abandoned elevated rail lines and green girders overhead. At this weekend's Boston Social Forum, there was quite a bit of discussion about the so-called protest pit. Here's South African poet Dennis Brutus speaking at the Boston Social Forum.
Well, that's the designated free speech zone. And we're being told that if you want to speak politically next week at the time of the convention, you will have to agree to become part of that corral and to be penned in there and to submit to the controls. And you know, in Los Angeles, they had the dangerous experience of people being penned in an area and then being told by the police you were given a certain time to disperse, and there was only one single exit, and 1,000 people trying to get out, and then the police charged them on horseback. And I'm telling you, you must be prepared to take a stand on this issue. You have to say, that all of Boston is a free speech zone. And there's one serious consequence if you don't. You may lose your voice, and they will roll over you if you submit to that restraint. If you submit to that encroachment on your freedom, you will find not only will you lose your voice, but the time may come in November where suddenly there's a red alert, and then you're told you've lost your vote.
South African poet Dennis Brutus speaking on Sunday at the Boston Social Forum. Last week, U.S. District Judge Douglas Woodlock called the conditions for protesters in Boston, quote, an affront to free expression and a festering boil. Again, that wasn't a protester describing the conditions. That was the judge. but he refused to order changes to the so-called free speech zone. In response, a coalition of protest groups and civil liberties organizations has appealed to the First Circuit Court of Appeals. Meanwhile, late last week, authorities announced they're lowering the maximum number of protesters allowed in the pit from 4,000 down to 1,000. They said because of concerns of overcrowding. So far, it appears the only people that have actually gone into the pit have been activists protesting the official protest area. We're joined right now by Ursula Masny-Latos, who is executive director of the National Lawyers Guild Massachusetts chapter. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you for having me here.
It's very good to have you with us. What can you talk about this?
Well, first of all, it was not the decision of city officials to lower number of people in the zone. This was the order that came from the judge. The judge was really appalled what he saw during a tour of the site on Thursday. And after touring the site, the judge ordered the city to allow only up to 1,000 people in the zone. And in addition to that, he ordered the city to make one more exit from the zone, because right now there is only one access area, I mean path, and one exit from the area, which is very problematic because it's under train tracks. And at the point where people are supposed to leave the area, the tracks are quite low. So anyone who is taller than 5 feet five would not be able to leave the area without ducking.
How has it come to this point, and how can you have a situation where the judge, not the protesters, is using terms like the site is an affront to free expression and a festering boil, and yet ultimately rules, refuses to order the changes to the zone?
It's very difficult to speculate what influence the judge's decision. However, during the hearing on Thursday, the judge met with Secret Service agents twice. He ordered two breaks, and during those breaks, he had briefings with several Secret Service individuals. So after those briefings, he came back from his chamber and he delivered his ruling. How we got here, we started the process long time ago. We had our first meeting with the police department and representatives from the city and the Democratic National Convention Committee in October of 2003. And we continued those meetings until July 14th. During our first meetings, everything looked like we might be able to have a great space for protesters. The city would respect everyone who would come here to exercise their First Amendment rights. However, during our last meeting on July 14th, we learned that the city actually changed its plans and decided to, first of all, make the area smaller than what was planned, put a double fencing around the area, put a netting above the area. And we also learned that no one would be allowed to have tables for literature in the whole soft zone, which is quite large. And the third issue that was presented to us on July 14th was that the city decided to put a fence around the whole soft zone. So we are talking about a time period of less than 2 weeks before the convention. So we really didn't have a chance to discuss any other alternatives. And the only thing that we were forced to do was to file a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm. And what do you expect to happen now?
Well, we don't know. We were supposed to file briefs this morning, and hopefully the First Circuit Court decides today what the city is supposed to do with the area.
Ursula Masny-Latos, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild, the Massachusetts chapter. When we come back, Danny Schechter, the news dissector, will be talking about the big T, No, we're not talking about the subway system here in Massachusetts, in Boston. We're talking about terrorism and the brush that protesters are being painted with. Then we'll talk about another form of suppression of free speech. The governor of South Dakota has pulled Teen Wire, which is a Planned Parenthood sex education wire, from the National Library website. We'll also hear from Gloria Steinem and Jim Hightower. Stay with us. Basho, Pavan Hindustan, here on Democracy Now!, breaking with convention, war, peace, and the presidency. It is our special all week as we broadcast from the National Convention of the Democrats here in Boston. We're broadcasting from Cambridge Community Television. I'm Amy Goodman. Over the past several weeks, Homeland Security Chief Tom Ridge and other Bush administration officials have put forward several warnings of possible terror attacks during the DNC. And though there has been no concrete evidence that such attacks are likely or real, they've been consistently reported in drumbeat fashion in the press. Then last week, the so-called threat barometer took a new twist. The FBI said it had received credible information that a domestic group characterized as terrorist was plotting to attack journalists and their equipment here in Boston. Over the weekend, all the networks reported on this threat. Several reported on the precautions they were taking. In response, the DNC erected a huge mesh net over the media tent area on the grounds of the Fleet Center to prevent any possible attacks on journalists. On Fox News, the network's correspondent assured viewers she was taking precaution. She held up a gas mask and declared herself prepared. Well, the media scene here in Boston is quite stunning. Some have called it a circus, which was underscored by the big party on Saturday night for journalists that was sponsored by the Boston Globe that had a Ferris wheel in the middle of it. More than 15,000 journalists have poured in. They outnumber delegates 3-1. Danny Schechter is with us of Media Channel. He writes a daily blog called The News Dissector. You can check it out at mediachannel.org. Welcome, Danny.
Well, I've been doing these conventions for many, many years, and this is sort of a media reunion. It's a media convention as well as a political convention, and a lot of people who know each other from 88 or from 92 or 96 or 2000 are here kind of catching up with each other. There's more schmooze going on so far than news. And the whole terror threat seems to be driving a wedge, or an attempt to drive a wedge, between the media and the protesters, lest the media become too sympathetic, I believe, with the protesters, or, you know, give them a platform for their views, the substance of their views. rather than simply their presence as a symbolic force here. And what's interesting is that a survey in National Journal found that not too many people really take this seriously at all. It doesn't have a lot of legs, so to speak, or traction with the media. But yet in the national media, it's become the big issue. I've had people tell me, watch out, be careful, and all the rest of it. But I think the real media story here is the lack of media coverage of the convention on network television. Yesterday here in Boston, all the news anchors from ABC, NBC, and CBS, rather, Brokaw and Jennings, were here at a panel discussion at Harvard, along with Jim Lehrer of the NewsHour. And what emerged in an interesting way is that Jim Lehrer, who's often the most conservative and restrained of all people on the planet, found himself becoming the critic of the network, saying as a citizen, not as a journalist, my God, but as a citizen, he was very concerned about the lack of coverage. You have an article in the New York Times today, I can hold it up here, of all the anchormen and their comments. And here you have the head of ABC News, David Westin, who is a lawyer, by the way, not a journalist, saying, if he thought it was important, he would go to Disney and demand more airtime. But of course, he doesn't. Now, this is only the most tense political race we've had in this century, certainly, and probably in our country's history, the most decisive one. And the networks are responding by covering it less, not more, because they believe that the only news is the horse race between Bush and Kerry. But what about all the constituencies here who have a lot to say, and the progressive forces here who are being marginalized and not covered? And I think this shows us, in a way, how media has become sort of an underminer of democracy rather than a facilitator of it. And I think that's what concerns us. At Media Channel, we set up Media for Democracy, which is a new network of 25,000 members who have been writing emails to all the networks who are concerned about this, because we see the lack of coverage as another sign that media does not take democratic debate seriously.
And also, you have the same network saying, well, it's so scripted, that's why we're not going to cover it. But when they go to the prime time at night, 1 hour, what they're going to end up with is the most scripted aspect of this convention, rather than the investigation of the money trail behind the scenes.
Look, these are the same networks that spent a full week on the Ronald Reagan funeral. Hardly a news event of great moment. They created it into a news event. They blew hot air into it. They created, a week of mourning unprecedented in our history, really, to have that type of media attention devoted to the death of a former president. It was totally uncritical. It was total, as you know, you reported it fully. But here the same networks have now turned around and saying that political debate, that the kind of under the surface tensions in this political process is not worthy of coverage. And I think that's scary, but it's also consistent with the kind of coverage we've been seeing throughout the Bush administration. Uncritical, one-note coverage of the war that was more about selling than telling. And I know you made a film about that. I've made a film called WMD, called Weapons of Mass Deception, about the coverage of the war. This is the key issue in our democracy. Do we have an independent and responsible media or not?
You talk about making a film, Weapons of Mass Deception. Is this film going to be seen across the country?
Well, the fight of independent filmmakers first is for the funding to make the film. I've managed to do that. Now the fight is for distribution to get the film seen. We just previewed it last night here in Cambridge, got a great response to it. I've shown it at a few festivals, and now I'm trying to work out the distribution details.
So at the same time that you have the media now flagellating itself, how did we get it so wrong? And the news anchors yesterday at the Harvard Kennedy School talking about, well, we're not lie detectors. When you have critical documentaries like yours, it seems as difficult as ever to get them out.
Well, the Michael Moore success has opened a door, at least. It's shown that there is a large market for independent documentary filmmaking. It has shown that you can make money, as he is doing, with a film that's hard-hitting and the like. Now, will this penetrate into the market-driven values of the media business? That remains to be seen. The indications are encouraging. We have at WMDthefilm.com, we have Tim Robbins, posted the trailer for the film. We're trying to get it out. We're trying to get it seen. And that's our struggle right now. You know, you have that we years ago, we talked about we need the means of production. Well, we have the means of production now. Do we have the means of distribution? Democracy Now is demonstrating that distribution is possible with persistence and hard work to get more outlets for your broadcast.
One last question, Denny, and that is on this issue of protesters being painted as terrorists. Now journalists being told who they have to be concerned about here are protesters because they could be disguised terrorists. Do you think this is a dry run for the Republican convention
well,
in
New York?
It's
another wedge issue. And unfortunately, the Democratic Party, which seems to want to tone it down here in Boston, want to keep the issues muted as much as possible, keep protest voices stilled, is going along with this. We haven't heard the party elders speaking out for the right to dissent and for the right of people to be heard. And that is shameful, in my view.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. Danny Schechter, the news dissector. His film is called WMD. His new book is Weapons of Mass Deception. Danny, answer that phone.
Thank you very much. See, my next appointment is calling. Thank you, Amy.
It may be one of the networks calling to ask to air
Stan
your
Rather
film.
To respond to my comments.
Don't miss sure. that moment. Well, as we talk about crackdown on dissent right now, I want to turn to Dominic Washington. He's a spokesperson for Planned Parenthood, the Minneapolis, or rather the Minnesota, South Dakota chapter. I met him last night at an event celebrating Planned Parenthood here at the Democratic National Convention. Hundreds of people gathered. And he pulled me aside to talk about something alarming that had taken place in South Dakota in the last few weeks around the issue of censorship.
TeenWire.com is Planned Parenthood's teen-oriented sexual health information website. And 3 weeks ago, Governor Mike Rounds, the governor of South Dakota, essentially ordered the South Dakota State Library Board to remove a link that it provided on its state library website. The normal procedure for whether or not a link is going to be made available on a website is that the library board votes to approve it or disapprove it. And the library board in the past has voted unanimously to put and keep Planned Parenthood's TeenWire.com on its website. But in May of 2004, Bishop Robert Carlson of the Sioux Falls Archdiocese wrote a letter to Mike Rounds urging him to remove the TeenWire.com site from the State Library Board website. Governor Rounds, acting on that request, went to the State Library Board. The Library Board voted against him. Later the afternoon of the same the day of the same vote, he sent an aide to the Library Board, and the aide instructed the Library Board that whether or not they could either A, continue to vote against it, or B, the governor would remove it himself. So the governor, had a second vote, and this time voted to remove the website rather than engage in a political fight with the governor. Reaction across the state was unified and outraged. People could not believe that the governor would use the weight and the power of his office to essentially remove a book from the shelves of shelves of a library, which is essentially what he did by ordering the link be removed from the website.
What about the newspapers in South Dakota?
Newspapers across the state were unified in their outrage at the governor's move. The Rapid City Journal, as a point of fact, which is one of the more conservative newspapers, I would say, in the country, blasted the governor for his move, calling it just outrageous. The point that they made was that while religion is fine to guide a politician or a public official's decisions regarding public policy, it should not dictate it.
What's on this teen website?
TeenWire.com is an award-winning website that's visited by approximately 500,000 parents and teens each month. And what's on it is information about sexual health, sexually transmitted infections, pregnancy, AIDS, HIV, the gamut, just it runs the gamut of sexual health information. Planned Parenthood, of course, encourages parents to view the website with their children, but unfortunately, the comfort level for a lot of teenagers is not there, and so TeenWire.com offers them a way to access information about sexuality that is comfortable, and it really speaks their language to them.
So what's Planned Parenthood going to do about this? How long has TeenWire been up?
Well, TeenWire has been a part. TeenWire has been around since 1999. It was made available through a generous private grant and has been a part of the state of South Dakota, as a part of their state library website since early last year, 2003. Planned Parenthood has been on the forefront of challenging the governor's decision and will continue to organize support for the website, of which there is plenty in the state.
Has this happened in any other state?
To my knowledge, no. It hasn't happened in any state where a governor has come down and used the weight and power of his office to remove TeenWire from the state website. So this is new ground, and while it's unfortunate, it's symptomatic of a growing problem that we have across this country.
Dominic Washington, a spokesperson for Planned Parenthood in Minnesota and South Dakota. I was speaking to him yesterday at the World Trade Center Seaport here in Boston. It was a large event for Planned Parenthood. Hundreds of people came out, activists and Congress members. The sister of John Kerry was there. She has long worked with Planned Parenthood. Interesting, John Kerry on his campaign trail has said that he considers that, quote, life begins at conception. He says he's opposed to abortion, but supports choice, opposed to abortion personally. While some Catholic bishops, however, believe John Kerry should be refused communion for his support for legal abortion and access to reproductive health care. This weekend in Boston, hundreds of people came out to celebrate him, though there was a small anti-abortion group in the anti-war demonstration that sat down in the road trying to take attention away from the anti-war protests and lay down in the road. This weekend, Gloria Steinem spoke at the Planned Parenthood event. The veteran feminist, pro-choice activist, Gloria Steinem.
I know we keep telling each other how important this election is, but I think we can't say it to ourselves and to everyone around us and to the nation enough. I'm an old person. And I'm 70. Hello. I want a little dignity here. And I can't... it's shocking, isn't it shocking? And I have never in my life, in a long life of caring deeply about elections, ever since my mother used to say to me when I was a very little girl, whenever she heard Franklin Roosevelt's name, tears would come to her eyes, and she would say, "We were so poor, and he helped us." And it made me understand that government is connected to us, or should be connected to us, and truly can make a difference. Never since then have I felt that there was an election of this kind of importance. We understand, those of us in this room, that reproductive freedom is not a single issue. It is a fundamental human right. Whether or not women have reproductive freedom, and men too, we should remember, because poor men from racial and ethnic minorities have been subject to forced and coerced sterilization. You know, this is a right that includes all of us. That this fundamental human right is something that determines the entire rest of our lives. It determines whether we are healthy or not, whether we can be educated or not, what our incomes are, whether we have power over our own lives. There is nothing more fundamental than the idea that the government does not have a right to decide when and whether we have children. Only we have that right. But because I understand that the that it's, you know, important to be positive, because I realize that Bush is accusing all of, you know, he's getting on television and saying, I'm just looking at friends here, is Grazia Molina Depec the organizer?
I'm 73.
So. 73. I think that, you know, we all understand that it's fundamental, and also that it indicates a worldview. It happens that whether you support reproductive freedom or not is the single biggest indicator of what your position is on the environment, what it is on capital punishment, what it, you know, it is a worldview. And since there, you know, the idea is to be a positive and not, at least for candidates and so on, because part of the heart of Bush's campaign is, you've seen this ad probably that says, pessimism never created a job or something like that. And so, yeah, well, neither did Bush ever create a job. He's lost millions of jobs. And since I'm not running for office, I thought I'd take it upon myself to remind us of a few of the health issues that go with reproductive freedom. This is from a little people's indictment that I have made of Bush. I tried to make it funny, but it was not possible. Okay. This is count six. Bush is a danger to health and safety. He turned Texas into the most polluted state in the United States or Canada and is now doing the same for the nation. For example, he has opposed 200 environmental and public health laws, weakened the Clean Water Act that has been supported by six past administrations, lowered standards for mercury in food and arsenic in drinking water, abandoned a campaign pledge to regulate carbon dioxide emissions, and in the last 3 years presided over an unprecedented decline in standards for meat, seafood, and drinking water. He has also increased the need for abortion. He has increased the number of unsafe births, and he has increased population pressure on the environment because he has opposed sex education, family planning, and emergency contraception. This last, as we know, against the advice of his own experts. AIDS education has been put under the influence of religious extremists. At the same time, 8 out of 10 working families have no health insurance. The number of patients forced into emergency rooms has increased, thus health costs are transferred to the taxpayer, and Bush opposes penalizing corporations for creating these health hazards. Therefore, to a greater degree than any other president, he bears responsibility for the following. 1 in 3 Americans gets cancer. As you can see why they don't want me speaking at the... Bush is giving us cancer. But, I mean, he is giving us cancer. Asthma and other diseases are skyrocketing in children. 7 out of 10 Americans have at least one chronic disease, and 1 in 5 is living with 2 or more chronic illnesses. And this last group with 2 or more chronic illnesses has increased 20 million people over predictions even in the last year alone. So I repeat, Bush is a danger to our health and safety. I can think of no group that is more effective in this election than Planned Parenthood because of the trust level that people feel for it, and because, I'm sorry to say, for a long time, the trust in politicians and political campaigns has been diminishing. Therefore, the message about what Bush's real positions are and what the impact of those positions is on your and my daily lives is best given out by people with this kind of credibility, and Planned Parenthood is unique in having served 1 out of 4 American women and having an over 80% trust rating. So I hope you will you know, just kind of think how you would feel the morning after the election on November 3rd if we didn't win. I mean, I don't want to even say it. Okay. All right. Okay. But just think about it and then take that feeling and use it now to give more money, to give more time, to get more voters out, to get more positions out. And then we will come back here for one hell of a victory party.
Gloria Steinem speaking last night in a celebration of Planned Parenthood on the eve of the Democratic National Convention. Also there was Peggy Carey, the sister of John Carey, who has long supported Planned Parenthood. This is Democracy Now!, breaking with convention. After our break, Jim Hightower. Stay with us.
Yesterday I saw you standing there with your hand against the pane, looking out the window at the rain. Your tears were not in vain, but I guess we both knew we'd never be the same, never be the same. Why must we hide all?
Patti Smith here on Democracy Now!, breaking with convention, war, peace, and the presidency. We are broadcasting from the Democratic National Convention. We're working with Cambridge Community Television with the great folks here across the river. I'm Amy Goodman. This week, the Democratic Party will anoint John Kerry of Massachusetts as its nominee for president. He faces George Bush from Texas in November. Over the next 4 days, Democratic Party officials are reportedly looking to tone down their rhetoric towards President Bush, believing that enough voters are disillusioned with the president that Kerry doesn't need to directly confront him. Well, the former Texas Agriculture Commissioner doesn't quite feel the same way. He is upping the rhetoric against the president. He is Jim Hightower, and today we bring you more political subversion from him. His latest book is called Let's Stop Beating Around the Bush. What's your tour called, Jim?
I am on a 50-something city Show Bush the Door in 04 tour.
What irks you most about the president of the United
States? Well, it's nothing about him personally. Rather, it is the rabidly right-wing zealotry that these people have brought into national politics. You know, I've been watching the Bushites for 9 years now, 5 years as governor of Texas and then now in the White House. And I've come, you know, for my scientific observation to this academic conclusion of these people are nuts, just absolutely bullgoose loopy. This is not a matter of, I mean, their policies are Orwellian, Ayn Randian, Jerry Falwellian, Strange Lovian attempt to supplant our democracy with their corporate vision of autocracy, plutocracy, and empire. This is not just another election. It's a big time in America, I think. And I've been doing, as you have, a whole lot of travel around America the last several weeks and months even, and I find that people are aware of it. I saw a bumper sticker on a pickup truck in my town of Austin, Texas, and it said, where are we going and what am I doing in this handbasket? People have some sense that we've been led down a rabbit trail off the true path of America.
We've been spending a lot of time talking about dissent right now, right, and the so-called protest pen.
Yes.
And the only thing the protesters are doing are protesting the protest pen.
Exactly.
But where does this crackdown on dissent come from?
Well, George Bush began this when he first decided to run for president. Karl Rove, of course, his political Svengali, was the creator of it. There was protests in front of the governor's mansion in Texas on the public sidewalk, the site of protests over the eons in Texas. And this was the time, 1999, when the national media was coming to look at this guy, because clearly he was getting a lot of money and support to run for president. And so they didn't want these pesky little protesters out front. And in particular, these protesters were challenging his lapdog performance on behalf of the polluters, in particular Enron and Kenneth Lay. So they had the police remove the protesters from the sidewalk, saying it was a threat to the public for them to be there, and of course it endangered themselves to be on the sidewalk. Therefore, they should go to a parking lot out of sight of Bush and out of sight of the national media. And that was the beginning of this, what I call Bush zones that have been created. Of course, America used to be a protest zone. We had a wonderful incident last year in Crawford, Texas, a group of peace protesters, about 100 of them caravanning in cars, going to the Bush Ranchette just outside of Crawford. And they are driving through Crawford, and they're met there by Donnie Tidmore. And Donnie is the chief of police, and he's got a barricade there. And they get out of the cars, and the leaders get out of the cars and walk up and say, "What's this?" And he said, "Well, you have no permit to protest in Crawford." And they said, no, Donnie, we're not going to protest in Crawford. We're going through Crawford to the ranch." And Donnie said, "Well, just by your very presence of being here, you are a protest." The logic cell in Donnie Tidmore's brain was not functioning that day. And they said, so they tried to argue with him, tried to make a little common sense with him, and that was not functioning. So Donnie arrested five of the protests. They became the Crawford Five. And they were later convicted by a jury in Crawford for demonstrating. And they, at the trial, it was even said, Tidmore himself was asked, if somebody came into town wearing a peace button, would that constitute a protest under your ordinance? And he said, it could be a protest. So it could be a sign of a demonstration. So this is the level of absurdity. The good news is the great civil liberties lawyer Jim Harrington took their case, and they were thrown out of court by a Waco judge a little bit later. But nothing will stop these folks.
In your book, Let's Stop Beating Around the Bush, you have a whole, not just chapter, but whole section, You'll Never Have to Feel Alone Again, My Friend, which is about surveillance, which is about the crackdown on dissent. Can you talk about the new toys for Big Brother?
Well, there are all kinds of wonderful new gimmicks that are available, including, I don't know if you've been chipped personally, but this is actually a phrase now in the corporate intelligence world, that rather than having to use credit cards and the inconvenience of that, you can simply have a chip put into your tip of your finger, and then that little baby can be scanned at the supermarket or at your ATM machine. And they say, well, after all, this is so much safer, you might lose your credit cards, you know, not thinking that maybe your determined burglar would whack your finger and then run around scanning your finger everywhere across America. I mean, again, the absurdity. You know, Lily Tomlin has said, no matter how cynical you get, it's almost impossible to keep up. and that's some of the stuff I write about.
8-2 postmaster?
Yes. Well, the post office itself has been asked to be spies on We the People and on our transactions in the post office. And if we buy an extraordinary number of stamps, for example, that needs to be reported to your Homeland Security force.
So, what do you mean?
Literally, if you seem suspicious to your postal clerk, the clerks are instructed to report any suspicious activity to their superiors, and that information supposedly goes to the Homeland Security and the FBI,
and what's,
just to check you out.
What is Spy Inc. all about?
Well, Spy Inc. is the movement of corporate spies now. ex-CIA officers, FBI officers, etc., now going to work for corporations to spy against competitors, to spy against people who file lawsuits against them, to spy against who knows what. But there's a whole cadre. They have their own association, annual meetings, and that sort of thing of corporate spies getting together to discuss snooperism.
We've been talking to Jesse Jackson today, and we were talking about a BET CBS News poll that said, especially African Americans believe overwhelmingly that their vote won't be counted, overwhelmingly opposed to Bush, and yet a very tepid response to John Kerry. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that? You're here at the Democratic National Convention.
Several aspects of that. One, I can't imagine why they would possibly think their vote wouldn't be counted, since we've had quite a bit of history of it not being counted. So you can understand the concern. And one of the biggest questions that come to me as I travel around with this book and elsewhere is the fear about the touchscreen voting system and whether our votes will get counted. And we have some evidence that it won't. But in terms of Kerry himself, I think it's an essential first step that we get rid of Bush. So what I find is not wild enthusiasm particularly for Kerry, but a unified effort to ABB anybody but Bush, get this guy out, because they're not only nuts, they are dangerous. So that is a step that we have to take. Now, having done that, that's not a progressive victory to get rid of Bush. That just brings us back to ground level again. There's that old song, "It felt so good when it stopped hurting," and that's the way we'll feel. And that will feel good for a while. But November 3rd is an awfully important date for us, because we will then have the opportunity to begin to put our best agenda forward and our best progressive organizing forward to retake the debate in the country for health care for everybody, good jobs at good wages, et cetera, and be in the face of the Kerry Edwards administration. We're going to have to make them as progressive as they can be. They're not going to do it on their own.
But if John Kerry were to win, and he won on a platform that you might consider very watered down, isn't that the mandate he thinks he will have?
Well, I don't think so. I think he knows they've watered down the platform. I think he's had some experiences in the primaries confronting farmers and workers in Iowa and New Hampshire and elsewhere who've lost their jobs as a result of NAFTA and the WTO. So it's no longer...
He was a strong supporter.
Exactly.
Of.
So it's no longer a cocktail party chatter discussion about the globaloney trade scams that they've shoved down our throat. He understands real people are at risk here for the first time ever. So I think we've got a chance to, and particularly with Edwards, to make this a more progressive administration than it otherwise would be. We saw pressure work in the primaries, and we, just as the corporations are going to be pressuring him, we have a responsibility as democracy builders to be in their face. Now, that doesn't mean we have to put all of our cookies there by any means. We've got to be out at the grassroots working with those folks we're going to elect to state legislature and to city councils and mayors and build that true grassroots movement at the ground level.
Jim Hightower, you write about CEOs averaging $25,000 an hour.
Yes, this is, and yet the Boschites would say, well, don't be talking about any class war. Well, hello. As you've seen recently, wages for ordinary folks are not even keeping up with inflation these days. CEOs, though, are getting fatter than butcher's dogs. Whether they are successful as CEOs or not, they still make a killing. This is part of the gross disparity of income in our society that has become a real issue. We're not talking about being against people making money. You know, Mark Twain said, I'm opposed to millionaires, but it would be dangerous to offer me the position. You know, so I'm not against people making money, but I'm against greed. I'm against them making money at the expense of everybody else, the Walmartization of our workforce in America.
Jim Hightower, I want to thank you for stopping by here on your tour. Let's Stop Beating Around the Bush is the name of Jim Hightower's latest book, New York Times bestselling author. Thank you for being with us. And that does it for today's program, broadcasting from Cambridge Community Television. So many people to thank, so little time to do it in. Our producers, Mike Burke, John Hamilton, Shroof Abdelkaddous, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Nell Geiser. Special thanks to Julia Dengel. Also, our director, Uri Galed, Mike DeFilippo, our chief engineer, and the folks here at CCTV, John Donovan and Dennis Dutra, as well as Arkman Martins, Holly Gettings, James Barabas, Gordon Breyer, Daniel Cashin, Sean Clark, Sean Affel, Matt Landry, Evan Reagan, Vaughn Simpkins, and Susan Fleischman. Also, special thanks to Boston Neighborhood Network as well. Tomorrow, we will be talking with parents of a young man who committed suicide after leaving Iraq. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us from the Democratic National Convention in Boston.